Hello and welcome to the Bitcoin Dad Pod, recorded on July 28th, 2023. I'm your Bitcoin Dad, and today I am recording solo because Chris is on a weekend away. On today's show, I'm going to discuss the launch of FedNow, the Federal Reserve's new payment system for instant payments. The U.S. House of Representatives Financial Services Committee has passed submitted a bipartisan crypto market bill. Kind of interesting. Probably won't go anywhere, though. In economics, there was a really interesting article from Goring and Rosenzweig about the patterns of commodity bull runs and how this relates to the global dollar standard and shifts in global monetary standards. Prosys BTC had an interesting post on the shifting Overton window of Bitcoin discussion. It was kind of interesting. In a way, Bitcoin is at a place and a level of adoption and success that no one could have imagined even 5 years ago. There's also an article from last month about how Argentina paid off $1 billion of IMF debt using RMB. Sort of an interesting detail there. We can get into that. In privacy, there's an interesting trial going on against the creator of a Bitcoin privacy service called Bitcoin Fog. He's being accused of various illegal things, and a lot of the evidence against him is from Chainalysis, basically using heuristics to attribute ownership of Bitcoin or cryptocurrency across blockchains to an individual and then claim that they have done something illegal based on the movement of these funds. As a result of this trial, the director of investigations at Chainalysis has submitted a statement and really cannot point to any science behind Chainalysis. It's really a system of best guesses. And so there's a great argument that it just does not belong in courtrooms. So that would be nice. There's also a story of a FBI raid that ended up with Mastodon users having all of their chats confiscated by the FBI. So that's a way to talk about privacy and how just getting off Twitter doesn't solve the issues of privacy online. There are quite a few articles and a podcast this week about energy and Bitcoin. I think an interesting thing to mention is the concept of degrowth, which is not really an economic theory, but sort of is. And it might lie at the heart of a lot of the COP21, which is this global climate target conference that they have every year. And so we can discuss that concept. And then I'm just going to mention a really interesting conversation with a couple of energy and commodity investors, including Rosenzweig. That's where I got the Rosenzweig article from. Then in Bitcoin OpTech 261, there's some discussion of Lightning Protocol and a really fun Stack Overflow conversation about Bitcoin seeds and the amount of entropy, how a Bitcoin address only has 12 seed words of entropy, but it still makes sense for the master seed to have 24 words of entropy. And then we have some boosts and an email, and that's the show. Chris and I have talked for a while about payment systems and how in the US, because Visa and MasterCard, the credit card companies really grew up in the US market, they dominate US payment systems, but other countries have different payment options for consumers and businesses. So most famously in China, because China did not allow Visa and MasterCard and the Western credit card companies access to the Chinese market in the same way that they got access to, say, perhaps European markets and, you know, the Americas, China developed kind of a different domestic payments infrastructure, which is still completely centralized, but just different. So they have a credit card processing company called UnionPay, which you might sometimes see in the US and Europe. Definitely you see it all over Asia. And then they also developed these online payment platforms, first Alipay, and then WeChat, which do pretty similar things, but they're essentially online neobanks, but they're not really banks. But they actually are now because I think they, at least briefly before the pandemic, did lending and various financial services in addition to facilitating online payments. Well, the US has sort of realized that it's quite backwards in terms of payment infrastructure, and FedNow is kind of a response to that. FedNow is a Federal Reserve platform. It's supposed to provide instant payments, and you can plug into it if you're a regulated financial institution in the US. And it's been launched on July 20th, and there are some early adopters who are currently interacting with it. And so a couple of these are Wells Fargo, US Bank, JP Morgan Chase, BNY Mellon. And then there are a couple of banks you probably haven't heard of that are probably a bit smaller, like First Internet Bank of Indiana, Hawaii USA Federal Credit Union. Now, because it only launched a few days ago, there's not a lot of news about it. I doubt there's much activity. But what's interesting from the Federal Reserve announcement is you can kind of get a sense of how this system works. Because in addition to the list of early adopter financial institutions, you have two more lists. One is financial institutions serving as settlement agents and liquidity providers. Okay, that's really interesting. So inside this system, it's not a flat system of banks interacting with each other. There is some sort of tiering in this system. And so there's another tier of participants who are settlement agents and liquidity providers. I think that anyone who's familiar with credit card processing will be a bit unsurprised, because with credit card processing, there are a series of middlemen financial institutions that provide liquidity for various payment recipients and providers. And so this seems quite similar to that. And then there is another list of participants called service providers supporting payment processing for financial institutions. And what's interesting is the first list, so the settlement agents and liquidity providers, there are banks on here. So BNY Mellon is on here, Bankers Bank of the West, The Bankers Bank. These are banks or credit unions who are doing this sort of liquidity provider and settlement agent function. But then if you look at the service providers for payment processing, BNY Mellon on here, again, they're on everything. They're this huge thing. But then you have a lot of other things like ACI Worldwide Corp, CSI, FIS, Jack Henry, Juniper Payments, Open Payment Network, Pigeon Incorporated. So what's going on here? Well, for instance, Pigeon Inc., they provide APIs so that you can build a portal to a payments infrastructure. And so the Pigeon API would sort of intermediate between an application like a, let's say, FedNow payments app that you might have on your phone and the institution that offers it. And so this institution might be a bank or a financial company, and then it would route probably to one of the liquidity and settlement providers in the FedNow system. So what I'm getting at is the FedNow system is, I believe, in many ways a response to both financial innovation outside of the US, but also perhaps a domestic critique of the US financial services industry, which is generally speaking quite expensive to interact with, especially for merchants, but for consumers who have credit cards, they're paying too. And they don't see it, but they're paying in the form of everything being more expensive, because credit card processing is expensive, and therefore it's built into every price. Ironically, the people who pay the most are people who pay in cash, because cash is actually very cheap and secure for a merchant to receive, because it's an instant settlement, but you can't have separate cost structures for cash payments versus credit card payments, just because it's hard to maintain that infrastructure and people don't like it. So everyone pays the inflated price due to the cost of credit card processing. This structure, based on a single press release, obviously, I haven't looked at the docs, how it works. I don't believe those are available. So I might have this wrong. At the same time, this looks very similar to how previous attempts at credit card networks and other traditional financial institution payment processing systems work. So I doubt that this is going to be popular, better, faster, cheaper than the existing credit card options. I think it's very hard to compete with an incumbent network because of the network effects of that, unless you've got something that's, you know, 10 to 100 times better. And based on what we've described, you know, this doesn't sound 10 to 100 times better than what currently exists. So we'll definitely be watching this. Hope that wasn't too boring. I've listened to a bunch of commentary and read a few articles about the crypto market structure bill that came out of the House Financial Services Committee. So if you're not in the US, or if you slept through your government class, the way that US government works is there are three areas of government: the executive, which is the president, the legal, which is the House of Representatives and the Senate, and the judicial. And so they're supposed to kind of balance each other and provide a check and disagree. Inside the legal pillar of government, you've got the House of Representatives, which is a bit larger. I think there's on average one representative for about 350,000 Americans or 300,000 Americans. And then you have the Senate, and there are two senators from each state. For a law to be ratified, or a proposed law to become a law, it has to pass through the House, then the Senate, and then be signed by the president. But I think it can be introduced in either the House or the Senate. And inside the House, there are these committees and subcommittees that are made up of elected representatives, and they debate current issues and also propose legislation. One of these subcommittees is called the House Financial Services Committee, and it's underneath the House Agriculture Committee due to just history. Agriculture used to be a bigger part of the economy than finance, which obviously has changed. So what's interesting about this bill is, one, there's not a lot of clarity on what's in it, because it's a proposal and it'll change a lot, but it appears to have the language that a lot of the crypto VCs and crypto investors and institutional crypto people want, where there's this concept that something can start as a security, as an ICO, and then become decentralized as the people who got to issue a security sold it to other people who then sell it to other people, and now suddenly it's a decentralized network, and their golden example is Ethereum. The interesting thing about this proposal is that six Democrats on the House Financial Services Committee joined the Republicans who proposed the bill. And what's interesting about these Democrats is they're basically just young. You can just predict who voted for it based on age on the Democratic side. Maxine Waters, a top Democrat on the House Financial Services Committee, did not like this bill. She's quite anti-crypto and claimed to want Gary Gensler to be more involved in crafting the legislation. However, the proponents of the bill said they also wanted productive engagement from Gensler, but he didn't provide any and was not available to work with. So they just went ahead and did this. I doubt that this is going to become law, because I think it first has to go through the Agriculture Committee, then be voted on in the House of Representatives, then be voted on in the Senate. So the goodwill and cooperation between the two political parties that temporarily existed in this on this bill, it would have to be maintained through a much larger pool of representatives, and that likely wouldn't hold. I'm just reporting on this because I think it's kind of interesting to see that there is movement in government. It's not like it absolutely doesn't work. There's the potential for laws to pass. There's the potential for individuals to work together in ways that you wouldn't expect. I think a lot of the future of legislation and what happens with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in terms of its legal treatment and how it's integrated into the financial system, I think a lot of it is up in the air. Because often when Chris and I talk about how we view the game theory of Bitcoin, we sort of see Bitcoin as this gold 2.0 plus potential open source payment system that eats the lunch of the US dollar, and therefore, of course, the dollar financial system would be logically very hostile to it. At the same time, that description is pretty inaccurate, because it's not like the dollar financial system is a single entity. It's made up of various branches of the US government, of various financial institutions, of individuals, of all sorts of billions of people spread across tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of institutions. And so people have different incentives depending on where they stand. If they think they can make money by moving first on Bitcoin or crypto, they're going to do it. And suddenly they're going to have different incentives than other people who on the surface might seem very similar to them and seem like they might have the exact same motivations. So I think it's just kind of interesting to note that things are happening that I certainly didn't expect. Proposed legislation that was bipartisan being submitted anytime in the next 2 or 3 years. And here it is. So we'll see where that goes. I read a really interesting article from Goring and Rosenzweig, who are natural resource investors. And I think, honestly, they seem kind of cool in that these are investors who buy stuff, tell you what they bought, and then try to get you to buy the same thing. So their motivations are pretty transparent, and that's cool. We sort of know where they're coming from. This article, the U.S. Reserve Currency and Commodities, is a excerpt from their Q1 2023 commentary, which is a much larger PDF you can download on their website. And they point out that there are these commodity cycles. And so they have a index that they've built that compares the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is like 30 US stocks that are very old. So it's not really, I wouldn't, you know, compare that to anything. It doesn't seem very useful today, but it goes back quite far. So they've got data from 1900 to 2022. And they make an argument that there are cycles that basically last around 50 to 70 years, where commodities go from being overvalued to undervalued. And, you know, and generally they're in this sort of range. And right now, commodities are severely, severely undervalued. And so they think, what is common across the three periods in the past 120 years where commodities have been similarly undervalued as they were today? Obviously, they have to fall in price a lot. Based on their research, oil's been down a lot, other commodities too, and this is also associated with economic slowdowns, which means slowdowns in demand for raw materials. They also think that excess money creation and easy credit also precede every period of radical commodity undervaluation. I think there's definitely some logic behind that, in that often when credit is quite loose and it's easy to get funding to build projects, there are big investments in commodity extraction, in shale gas, for instance, or oil or copper. And the reason that commodities are not monetary metals is because the demand is very volatile and the supply is very volatile. And so if you increase the supply, the price tanks very quickly. Stock to flow, actually. There's relatively little stock of commodities relative to the flow. And so periods of loose credit and easy money tend to result in investments in commodity extraction, which then tend to crater the price. Third, each period of commodity undervaluation is also associated with a mania somewhere else in the market. In the 1920s, there was a massive stock market boom. One of the high flyers was RCA, Radio Corporation of America, which reached a price in 1928 that it didn't return to until, I think, 1970. So, I mean, there was a real bubble. In the 60s and early 70s, there was the US Nifty 50, which were these sort of conglomerate growth stocks, which reached a 50x price to earnings ratio and then plummeted until the 90s. And then since 2010, we've just had the everything bubble where, you know, FANG stocks, cryptocurrencies, all sorts of things have contributed to, you know, massive gains in the price of financial assets. If you think about these three observations, I mean, they're all interrelated, right? You know, for the price of commodities to go down, it means people need to be buying other things. And if they're buying other things, then maybe there is a mania somewhere else in the market. The last observation that G and R make is that in the 1920s commodity undervaluation cycle, there was actually a big shift in the world reserve currency status when the crown went from the pound sterling to eventually the dollar after World War II. And since 1970, 60s and 70s, the last period of commodity undervaluation, this was when the Bretton Woods dollar standard fell apart and we moved to a world of fiat currency without changing our nominal reserve currency. I think that is a little bit misleading in that under the Bretton Woods standard, the reserve currency, I think, arguably, was actually gold, and the dollar was just a wrapper around it. And then we did shift reserve currencies in the 70s to the dollar, which suddenly the wrapper became the thing. And now we were in this sort of fiat untethered world. And there are many reasons why this shift happened. You know, I'm not saying it was necessarily evil or whatever. I mean, it obviously worked for a while, and obviously it had some costs too. This article suggests that we may be approaching another shift in global monetary standards. China is a part of that. Essentially, other large economies that don't have an incentive to be dollar-based, you know, they're a part of that. The ability of the U.S. to provide enough dollars to the world, that's a part of it. The reliability of the U.S. government as a guarantor of dollar debt, that's also a part of it. And the relative scarcity of commodities is also a part of that. Do oil-producing nations feel like sharing finite oil reserves for dollar tokens that can be created infinitely? It's an interesting question. The answer, I think, is maybe they're a little less excited about that proposal. Definitely give it a read. It kind of touches on a lot of the subjects we've talked about on the show. I don't think that there are any easy conclusions here, but there's a lot of fun context around it. Croesus BTC, also known as Jesse Myers, has a Substack that I guess I read it. And he gets into RFK Jr., who's sort of a fringe Democratic candidate in the U.S., and his statement about, you know, basically backing the U.S. dollar with Bitcoin. I think it's a pretty crazy proposal. I mean, crazy. On the one hand, I don't think there are enough Bitcoiners to attract a huge amount of popularity from a proposal like this. I don't think a non-Bitcoiner would be particularly interested or think it was a good idea to back T-bills with hard currency like gold, silver, platinum, or Bitcoin. I mean, one issue he's messed up here is platinum is not a monetary metal. Platinum is an expensive metal, but it has a relatively low stock-to-flow ratio. You know, as the price of platinum goes up, so does the production. So it's not a hard currency, and his plan is just factually inaccurate from the get-go. But I would say that RFK is probably less of a fringe candidate than, say, your standard libertarian presidential candidate. There are libertarian presidential candidates in the U.S. every year, and you never hear their name. I'm pretty sure there's also Communist Party candidates in the U.S., and you never hear their name. So RFK is still a fringe candidate, but he's bringing Bitcoin and its sort of, you know, capital gains taxes and its potential use as a hard currency backing debt and other things to the conversation. And it is being talked about a little bit. Obviously, this Substack is not the New York Times, but I believe this also has been mentioned in the New York Times. So the Overton window, and of course, Overton window means what is acceptable to be discussed. So I would say 5 years ago, if you went on a news show and said, let's back US government debt with Bitcoin, they would just cut the segment. I mean, it would be as appropriate as saying we should elect a horse to the Supreme Court. It's just not a serious statement and no one would take it seriously. But 5 years later, now we have admittedly fringe candidates talking about Bitcoin in the context of US government finances. So what does this mean? It means the window of conversation is shifting. Bitcoin is shifting closer to the mainstream, closer to a thing that most people are aware of. They know it exists. They sort of tacitly know it works because it exists, because we're still talking about it. And that just happens slowly with time, with every attack on Bitcoin that fails, with every block that succeeds. So it's kind of an interesting thing to note and ponder about. Now, there is an article about the IMF, or basically an IMF spokesperson, commenting on Argentina paying $1.1 billion of a $2.7 billion IMF loan in renminbi. I think this is actually old news. I think the original story is probably from last month, but I just noticed it recently, and I thought it was kind of interesting because, so first of all, if you hear, oh gosh, the IMF is accepting RMB payments for IMF debt, gosh, I thought the dollar was a reserve currency. Well, actually, the IMF has a thing called the SDR, Special Drawing Rights, and the SDR was a concept originally invented by Keynes. He called it the Bancor, and then the IMF, you know, much later sort of created something similar. And the idea was that just using gold and the dollar as the world's base money would give the US so much power that wouldn't it be better if we created this sort of multi-government money called a Bancor? One Bancor is worth, say, $100, 80 British pounds, whatever. I mean, obviously, this was in a world of fixed exchange rates, and it never, I think, would have worked anyway, because is it so useful to have this international money thing that only one institution issues and honors? Like, no, not really. But the idea of the SDR, the IMF, is that, hey, if you've got 10 SDRs, then you can give it to the IMF and say, I would like 10 SDRs worth of dollars or renminbi or Swiss francs. And, you know, one SDR, it contains a basket of currencies. I don't know what the exact basket is. And the renminbi has been part of the SDR basket since 2016. So obviously, it seems you could definitely make payments with currencies that are part of the SDR basket to the IMF. That said, it's pretty rare for large payments to be made in renminbi because the renminbi is not a internationally transacted currency. The CCP actually controls renminbi to dollar convertibility, so there's not a lot of renminbi circulating outside of mainland China. And so the fact that Argentina has a large amount of renminbi to pay the IMF with really speaks to Argentina's financial relationship with mainland China. Perhaps this renminbi comes from direct investment from Chinese corporations, perhaps from bilateral trade. Argentina traditionally produces a lot of beef. China consumes a lot of beef. I mean, on a per capita basis, they consume very little beef, but, you know, as a 1.3 billion people or something, they consume a huge amount of beef. So on the whole, not a big deal in my view. but also interesting. I mean, this is just another data point in that there are large international transactions, even involving international institutions that generally support a dollar-based world, and they're involving currencies, not the US dollar. So is the US dollar being dethroned? Well, maybe paper cut by paper cut, but certainly not quickly. In privacy news, there's an article from CoinDesk about the Chainalysis Director of Investigations testifying that she was unaware of the scientific evidence that supports Chainalysis Reactor software, which is used by law enforcement to do financial surveillance on blockchains and try to get people in trouble for their activity online. The reason that this statement is being circulated is because a lawyer, Tor Eklund, is representing a early Bitcoin adopter who's been accused of operating a cryptocurrency mixer. And he says, no, I didn't operate the mixer. And Chainalysis says, listen, all this Chainalysis connects you with the mixer and we think you were operating it. Well, it's important to establish that evidence in a criminal trial is based on fact, is very reasonable, can be understood by a jury. And that's why this lawyer has been trying to get Chainalysis to justify how their software actually works. Now, I have a statement from Beth Bisbee, who is the Director of Investigation Solutions for Chainalysis Government Solutions. Really rolls off the tongue. She is a former Drug Enforcement Administration, which is a U.S. government department that fights, you know, drug traffickers. It's generally a pretty horrible organization from what I've heard. I think she's essentially probably a salesperson at this point. You know, basically people from government are hired by companies that want to do business with government for their connections in government. But she describes how Chainalysis works a little bit. And I'll just quote her on this. Chainalysis clustering methodologies have not been peer reviewed in the sense that an academic paper would get peer reviewed with data and methodologies reviewed in a separate study by other scientists. However, every single clustering heuristic in the system has been reviewed by numerous Chainalysis data scientists, red flag, intelligence analysts, red flag, and investigators that specialize in blockchain analytics, red flag. So a lot of people that we employ say it works. It's kind of interesting to read. I've attached a link to the archive of this. I guess it's a written deposition, perhaps. And she even mentions the common input ownership heuristic. She calls it the co-spend heuristic. If two UTXOs are spent in the same transaction, either they are controlled by the same private key or the two private keys are accessible by the same person. So this is a big part of Chainalysis, where when they see two UTXOs, two unspent transaction outputs, which are essentially two chunks of Bitcoin, spent together and combined into a transaction, they assume that the spender controls both of them. Well, this is actually broken by Samurai Stonewall transactions, which are a way to collaborate to spend two UTXOs from two different people together. This is also broken by coin swap proposals, which are, you know, ways to essentially swap UTXOs over several transactions. This is also broken by PayJoin, which I think is a more advanced form of Stonewall transaction, which is a current proposal, which the Human Rights Foundation has a bounty out on the PayJoin privacy solution. So it's kind of interesting that Chainalysis is finally showing up in court and being challenged. And honestly, I think that if smart people ask enough questions at Chainalysis, they will probably come away with a lot of questions about whether or not this heuristic methodology for determining ownership of things online on blockchains should be permissible in court. Because honestly, it's definitely not scientific and could definitely get things wrong. And in my view, that means that it should not be admissible in legal cases. There is another bit of privacy news. And what happened was there is a server, a Mastodon server. Mastodon is a federated social media technology. I think it's gotten a real boost from Elon Musk buying Twitter and then just being his normal chaotic self and just changing everything and, you know, making people angry on it to the point that they didn't want to use it. So what Mastodon does is it basically is Twitter. It's basically a centralized server that gives you an account and you can send messages in various formats on it. What's different about Mastodon is I can run a Mastodon server, you can run a Mastodon server, but in practice, most people just go to the mastodon.org main server and sign up on there. And separate Mastodon servers can federate with each other. So my Mastodon server can talk to Mastodon.org if we configure it to. Of course, Mastodon.org could say that they don't like the Bitcoin Dad Pod server for various reasons, and they could, you know, cut that connection. So is Mastodon better than Twitter? I don't know. I mean, it's not end-to-end encrypted. The owner of the server that you're using controls moderation policies, controls all the data. And this is what happened with Colectiva.social. This Mastodon server was being administered by several people, and the FBI raided the home of one of the admins for an unrelated thing and confiscated all of their electronics, which is a pretty common sort of warrant item. You know, when someone is arrested, you know, the warrant says you can confiscate all their electronics. And I think that 20 years ago, that meant maybe a computer, maybe a answering machine with like a tape in it. But today, you know, all of your electronics, that could be a room full of stuff. You know, your Bitcoin dad has a huge amount of electronics. He has a freaking, you know, data center at home. You know, so if I was, arrested and all of my electronics were, seized, you know, I mean, honestly, I don't think they'd survive being moved. You know, I can imagine some, ape-like police officers like throwing my computers in a bus. You know, I don't know if they'd make it out alive. But when you think about it, you know, this sort of broad warrant standard is really, really bad in the modern world because things have changed. A lot of our life is online now. You know, if you seize my mobile phone, you know, there's pictures of my daughter in there. And now that, you know, we're going to have the police pawing through it. And, you know, there's stories that happens all the time. You know, some law enforcement folks, they see someone's electronics and they find, you know, nude selfies or something in there. And then they share them around because, you know, what are they going to do? I'm the cop. You know, they're the cops. You know, they can do what they want. So in the instance of Colectiva.social, what happened was there was a backup of all of the data from the Mastodon server on a hard drive that was seized. And now this becomes the property of the FBI, and they can copy it and do whatever they want. Because even if this person is not charged with a crime and or is let go, the FBI, first of all, they don't necessarily have to return all of those electronics. You know, that's a whole process, and things get lost, things get stolen by the authorities. That happens. But they can also copy all of the data. So this is kind of a wake-up call. Mastodon does not really solve many of the privacy and information security problems of online communication. It just moves them away from one central repository called Twitter to many different servers. And now you have to, you know, trust all the individual servers. And, you know, that's very mentally taxing. Is there a solution? I mean, potentially, I think Nostr is really interesting. I'm trying to get into it. I'm not really going to share my opinion until I use it a bit and kind of have more intelligent things to say. I think Nostr kind of has the scaling issues of many of these internet technologies. You know, doing a decentralized network is really, really hard. And so things like Nostr don't try to do it. They use these things called relay servers. But how decentralized are the relay servers? Who controls the relay server? And the way you do it is you say, well, you know, we'll design in such a way that even if a malicious entity is controlling a large number of these relays, it's not a big deal. Well, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. So privacy online is really hard. It's an unsolved problem. And, you know, when there is a solution, I will let you know. I doubt there will be one, though. I prepared a Bitcoin energy section before I remembered that Chris wouldn't be here this week, but I actually got some feedback that some listeners felt that Chris and I talking about energy was the worst part of the show, in particular because we express frustration with proposals to green human energy consumption by incorporating wind and solar power, but it doesn't sound like we propose a viable alternative. And I happened to speak to a Bitcoin miner last night, and we were chatting, and I thought I would just sort of share a little bit about, I mean, there's some articles here, but just a little bit about that conversation. And essentially, I want to clarify that I am not a carbon maximalist. I'm definitely not advocating for using polluting forms of energy like coal and diesel. I mean, I think they're likely always going to be used. I mean, people still burn wood occasionally for heat, and it's very bad for air quality. I mean, burning wood is cute when you live in a beautiful suburb and you have a nice chimney and it's a chilly day and you burn wood in your stove or your chimney and you have the family around it in sweaters and it's very nice. And I don't think anyone should feel like a climate criminal for doing that occasionally. I mean, I think that's a pretty fun little activity. This becomes a problem when you go to Mumbai in India and you have, you know, these massive slums and people are burning wood for cooking in the slum of a megacity. I mean, now you've got a freaking climate, air quality catastrophe on your hands. So you don't want that. What I'm getting at is that I think that the history of energy consumption shows that humans never really throw away a source of energy. Today, human civilization burns more wood for energy than human civilization did in the Middle Ages, when wood was the primary source of energy. That's just because human civilization is using so much more energy that wood burning is an insignificant portion of that energy mix. But in raw terms, it's sort of more tons of wood than humans were burning 600 years ago. So in terms of the kind of modern energy debate, I think that the point that Chris and I have been trying to make is that electrifying the economy, replacing fossil fuel burning systems with electric powered systems, so electric powered stoves, electric powered cars, is definitely going to reduce emissions locally where you're replacing a fossil fuel burning system. But the real issue is the source of that power. And in terms of replacing the energy generation infrastructure, what's happened in Germany and in other places that have embraced solar and wind power is that as they've built out solar and wind capacity, because those power sources are intermittent, they turn on and off depending on how much sunlight there is or how much wind is blowing, the way that power utilities have handled that intermittent turning on and off has been to invest in natural gas, which is better than coal. It produces less CO2 and pollutants than coal, but it is still burning fossil fuels. So I don't think that it's green to have to build a natural gas plant for every solar farm. You know, that's not a green solution. And so I think from what I've read, and I think if you want to hear smarter people make arguments for nuclear power, Lynn Alden has opined on this, on the potential for nuclear power. It's an incredibly dense energy source, and it is very green in the sense that it does not produce any carbon emissions. However, most humans in the developed world seem to be convinced that nuclear power is incredibly dangerous. I would invite them to go online and try and figure out how many people in the history of humanity have been killed by civilian nuclear power accidents. In fact, include all of the victims of the World War II nuclear bombings, and you will discover that fewer people have been killed by nuclear weapons than are killed by air quality problems as a result of coal burning in India in a year, which is, you know, wild to think about. But essentially, the issue that we see is that the solution to producing enough electrical capacity for the human race in a way that doesn't produce a large amount of carbon, which then results in a warming atmosphere, is to use this technology called nuclear that doesn't produce carbon, that is actually historically safe, but it's historically scary because it's associated with nuclear weapons. Every time there's been a nuclear accident, the reporting has been pretty bad. People just get incredibly terrified. As a result, it's just got incredibly bad optics. I don't know if this helps our bad energy takes, according to one of our listeners, but I hope that helps clarify that, you know, we're not saying that there's no point in investing in solar and wind. I honestly don't know enough about it to say, you know, it's completely useless. I mean, I do think that it is very problematic if you are using Chinese coal to produce so-called green technologies and then, you know, shipping them around the world, so, you know, mainly to Europe, and then saying, hey, look how green we are. You know, no, you displaced all the dirty industry to China. You made them do it and you're just a NIMBY, you know, not in my backyard. And I think that's hypocrisy. So I think that if there is a green solution, it doesn't involve balancing intermittent renewable energy with natural gas. And it doesn't involve, in my view, burning coal to melt silicon to make quote unquote green solar panels. You know, if that's the solution, then it's a dumb one, in my view. And I think that nuclear power, it's like literally harnessing the fundamental power of the universe. You know, another interesting soundbite I've heard, which I think is amazing if true, hopefully, is that a nuclear power plant, regardless of the cost in dollars, its energy return on investment is 6 weeks. As in, if you build a nuclear power plant, you know, however much it costs, but you have to invest a lot of energy. You have to, you know, create concrete. You have to refine some uranium. You do all this stuff. You assemble a plant. You turn it on. 6 weeks later, that plant has produced the equivalent amount of energy that went into it to produce it. And then now for the next 50, 80, however many years it operates, you're in the green. That's excess energy. Whereas with solar panels, it can take potentially 20 years for the solar panel to generate the same amount of energy that went into creating it. 20 years. Well, what if there's a hailstorm and it breaks the solar panel on year 4? Well, guess what? That solar panel was a very dirty solar panel because it was probably produced with Chinese coal. That's very problematic. I don't think that's a sustainable solution. Sorry if this was rambly. But if you want to learn more about, I think, kind of the disconnect, maybe the fight between the so-called ESG movement and maybe Bitcoin energy maximalists and, other commodity investors, other people who talk about oil and gas, I think, in a more pragmatic view, especially investors who, then might be accused of being amoral or something. There's a really interesting YouTube video I linked to, it's a podcast that involves Doomberg, who's, I think, the world's most popular financial energy blogger right now, and a couple other investors who talk about sort of energy and the narratives around it. And in that podcast, they mention the degrowth movement, which I believe is sort of this idea that GDP growth, the constantly expanding economy, this is just going to eat up all the resources in the planet and leave us with this sort of burnt cinder of a world. And so we actually have to kind of attack the concept of growth, happier with less. I'm just going to go ahead and say this is a really privileged point of view, because if you live in the developed world, then maybe you could imagine having a little less and being happy. But, first of all, even in the developed world, there are a lot of people who are very marginally surviving. It's a large number of Americans who are, a paycheck or an accident away from homelessness. Are you going to tell people like that they have to live less? No, they'll never politically accept it. There's also a huge amount of inequality, even within the developed world. But the real issue is the developing world. Countries like Argentina, countries that have relationships with the IMF and the World Bank, which we've detailed on other podcasts, are essentially, in my view, sort of financial neo-colonial organizations, because they engage with poor countries that generally have natural resources, and then they bankroll often autocratic, non-democratic political regimes that then reform these countries and these economies to make them integrate with an international system that sucks out their resources and saddles them with debt and does not increase meaningfully any metric of civilization and human well-being in that country. Life expectancy isn't going up too much. Infant mortality isn't dropping so much. People aren't getting wealthier. And if you have this view that we can only save the planet by keeping oil and coal and other natural resources in the ground, well, you run into this problem, in my view, where, well, what about the developing world? So, Europe was a colonial power for hundreds of years. And then since World War II, they've outsourced their military security to the US and instead spent on social welfare programs, and then recently spent on moving all of their dirty industry to China and India. And then now they're, this green paradigm. So they have not resulted in net emissions reductions by moving industry to China, where that industry was then powered by coal. And since the war in Ukraine, when there were disruptions to the energy relationships with Russia, especially in Germany, Europe immediately started burning coal to deal with winter spikes in demand for energy. So if you think that we have to keep coal in the ground and do more with less to save the planet, then, based on the actions of politicians and governments in Europe, that's a hypocritical statement, because that's not what people are doing. But the other issue is, are you going to tell the developing world that they're not allowed to use cheap hydrocarbons if they exist? They've been colonized, suffered a lot historically at the hands of Europeans, and then they're not allowed to use coal now, when you've got people living on $1 a day, $5 a day, like very low levels of human subsistence. I'm just pointing out that a lot of the world doesn't really have the ability to do less with less. They're sort of on the edge of subsistence, and so I think that obviously there are definitely problems with climate change and global warming. In my view, look at any graph of global temperatures, it's a hockey stick. It looks pretty bad, right? But if green policies result in situations like famines or energy shortages in the developing world, where people are very vulnerable, that would be criminal, in my view. So I think that these desires to decarbon the economy and whatnot, they have to be tempered with the fact that billions of people around the world are burning wood for fuel, and like cooking. And if you're asking them to reduce their carbon emissions, that's crazy. You can't do that. You know, they don't have enough resources to use another source of energy. I mean, look, if you're going to give them like high-tech energy, you know, especially like maybe nuclear power, cool, do that. But don't try to sort of coercively and non-voluntarily deprive poor people of energy. That is bad. Okay, that was a terrible, terrible meandering rant. Sorry about that. Here's an ad. The Bitcoin Down Pod is brought to you by Jupiter Broadcasting, which is Chris Fisher's network of podcasts. Got quite a few shows over there. Office Hours, which is this meta show about podcasting. If you're really into podcasts, you might want to check that out. Linux Unplugged, which is this, I don't know why, it's almost like the NPR. It's like the exciting NPR / daytime talk radio of Linux. You know, very exciting. They're always doing interesting things on that show. Self-Hosted, a show about hosting stuff at home. It's one of my favorites. I'm a big self-hoster. Love that show. You got to check it out. JupiterBroadcasting.com. Just search for Jupiter Broadcasting in a podcast app. Bitcoin Optech 261. We finally have some news from the Bitcoin mailing list. Well, actually, it's the Lightning Dev mailing list. Rusty Russell has proposed a simplified process for two nodes to close a mutual Lightning channel. And this new close process might enable child pays for parent fee bumping. That would be super cool, because one issue with the current Lightning protocol is that when you create a Lightning channel, you have to like lock in your fee rate that you close the channel with in the future, but you don't know what the price of block space in the future will be. So if fees are 1 cent per byte, you're like, okay, I'll put in an expensive fee of 10 sats per byte and I'll be fine. But then it's 2 years later and ordinals have been invented and 10 sats per byte is still being purged from the mempool. So you can't actually close your channel. You're in real trouble then. So you want to have the ability to close a Lightning channel in any fee environment. And so this is a interesting proposal. There are also some notes from the Lightning Summit, which was a meeting of Lightning developers in New York City. I don't pretend to understand those notes, but there are a lot of them. And then something fun, a Bitcoin Stack Overflow question. Someone was reading the Mastering Bitcoin book by Andreas Antonopoulos and had a question about seed words. Now, a seed word is the seed that creates the private key in your Bitcoin wallet. Your standard seed phrase for a wallet today will be 24 words, but a Bitcoin address only has 128 bits of entropy or security, which corresponds to 12 words. So why does the master seed of 24, but the addresses only have 12? Well, Peter Willa, the Bitcoin OG developer, has a pretty technical answer here. But the TLDR is that individual keys or individual Bitcoin addresses have only 2 to the 128 or 128 bits of security. And this is due to some algorithms that can kind of efficiently search the ECDSA curve for private keys. I mean, that's a lot of security, by the way. But it means that the master key, which has 256 bits, has additional security. And it makes sense for the master key to have additional security because you don't want it to be easy to crack the master key, because then it can crack all of the derivation keys. So basically, you hack one key and then you get access to all of the addresses of the wallet. But with the current setup where you have a 24-word 256-bit seed and then 128-bit addresses, it's impossible to crack the master seed, and it's very, 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 very difficult to crack addresses. So it sort of makes sense for the master to have more entropy. I explained this terribly. Sorry about that. I've been talking for a while. Remember, you can get in touch with the pod, BitcoinDadPod at ProtonMail.com, at BitcoinDadPod on Twitter. I was very proud of myself. I was actually on Twitter briefly this week, but consider joining the show Matrix channel. There's some details in the notes. And we got an email this week from the Sprinklr Geek, also known as Cinemotive, responding to Chris and I talking about some personal anecdotes around hiring contractors and, you know, sort of workforce in America. And he was pointing out that for his business, which involves digging holes and, you know, doing very difficult work, it is just a real challenge because culturally, a lot of the previous generation of contractors are just like, they're culturally not suitable to hire modern younger people. They're gruff, they're angry, they're pushy, and they're just not pleasant to work with. And this is sort of just cultural history of that industry. That means that it is very difficult to get young people to explore these careers because, one, they're physically difficult. Two, the people generally who they're working for are unpleasant. And three, everyone has been told to work in STEM. That's where the money is. That said, the Sprinkler Geek says he is super busy. He's booked out for months. He charges $85 an hour, and he takes 2.5 months off every winter. So what I gather from this email is that the Sprinkler Geek is doing okay with a non-STEM job and has a great lifestyle. And that sounds awesome. I observed is that, you know, if you're a parent who was programmed into going to college, pursuing a STEM career or something like that, working in an office, I think it would be very difficult to advise your child on potentially pursuing a career in trades because you just don't know that. You don't have a lot of experience. But one data point from the Sprinkler Geek, it sounds like some people are definitely making careers in the trades work for them. And so that might be an option for people. And I mean, and one nice thing about trades work is as a college student or maybe even a high school student, you know, you can intern or work at companies like that over the summer, like do manual labor. When I was younger, I painted houses for a summer. It was a really great experience, made some money. So thanks so much for sending an email in. And we had some big boosts this week. Ahanaga sent in 43,000 sats, a mega boost. Thank you so much. With the message, great show. I still think Plan B provides some great insights to the Bitcoin community. If nothing else, he's proved it's impossible to apply a rational model to predict the highs and lows in Bitcoin. Hey, thanks so much for the boost. And I totally agree. It is very difficult to model financial market activity. It's very emotional, these financial markets, or at least irrational. So thanks so much for the boost. Eric99 boosted in 50,000 sats, a real mega boost, with the message, stay humble, stack sats. That's a great meme. All about staying humble here. Mere Mortals podcast boosted in a row of ducks. Speaking of sketchy models, is there any serious proof to the oft-repeated mantra that the halvening drives the bull market? It makes sense on the surface, but so does stock to flow if you spend zero time investigating, which I tend to do because economics only marginally interests me. Yet you listen to this podcast, Mere Mortals. I know it probably plays a part, but what's a rough percentage? 90, 50, 10% of the reason for the number go up phenomenon in the bull market? Well, Mere Mortals, there is actually some, I think, a pretty good explanation from Lynn Alden. Because essentially what the halvening does, because the number of new Bitcoins cuts in half every 200,000 blocks, it means that if demand is constant, price will go up, even if demand doesn't increase. So that just means if there are 10 people buying Bitcoin and there are, you know, 12 new Bitcoins every block, and then there are suddenly 6 new Bitcoins every block and there are still 10 people buying it, they all want Bitcoin the same as they used to, then the price goes up because there's less issuance. It's just sort of a mathematical thing. How much does it go up? Good question. I don't think it's easy to predict that. Halleck boosts in 1,000 sats. No sad face this week, Dad. This show has quickly become the one I refresh fountain looking for. I have switched to boosting over streaming sats. I really like the concept of passive support like that, but I think too much is lost to fees. Thoughts on that? Yeah, that's a good point. I guess when you're streaming sats, you do pay a fee for every stream. So if you're streaming, you know, 5 sats a minute or something, you might end up paying, you know, up to 5 sats or maybe even more on fees. So that's problematic. I mean, I really like boosts. You know, they don't need to have a message, but it's nice to sort of see a chunk. When someone's streaming, it's hard to track how much they've sent. So, you know, you see like a lot of little stream chunks, but you're just scrolling and there's not necessarily an easy sum in the Helipad UI, which is the software I use to track boosts. So I think boostograms, it's easy to kind of see it, in my view, than the streaming. Also, I mean, streaming it is going to make Lightning nodes databases increase a lot. So, you know, the Lightning microtransaction, there's a cost to that for sure. Cultivator boosts in a row of ducks. Thanks for all the great content. I may not always agree with your economic viewpoints, but I think we both reach similar conclusions. Keep up the great work. Well, thanks for encouraging me while not always agreeing. That's always nice. The world needs more thoughtful content creators like you. Although people keep calling you dad, creeps me out just a little. I respect the pseudonymity. Glad Chris and Jupiter took you on. This is the only Bitcoin podcast I listen to. So Chris definitely took me under his wing, but I don't think I'm part of Jupiter Broadcasting. I think it's a little separate. I sort of viewed this as a way for me to mooch off Chris shamelessly, and also, you know, maybe provide a place for him to talk about Bitcoin, so it didn't take over the Linux content on his shows. I also want to thank Adevries17, who is not the Dutch economist, for a boost. And that is our show. Thank you so much to all of our boosters. If you get some value from the show, consider sending a boost. You can send a boost directly from the Podcast Index webpage without a new podcast app using Albee Wallet. You can find the Bitcoin Down Pod on the Podcast Index. There's a link in the show notes, and you can just send a boost right from the page. Or you can try a new value for value podcasting app. I currently use Podverse, which is cross-platform and integrates with Albee pretty well. Podverse is great, but it's not as good as AntennaPod. I'll be honest, I miss AntennaPod, but I have switched to Podverse. Fountain is the popular podcasting 2.0 app on Android, and Cast-O-Matic on Apple. We definitely get some boosts from there. Thank you so much for listening. This has been the Bitcoin Dad Pod, recorded on July 28th, 2023. I've been your Bitcoin Dad. That was a very long episode for one person talking. Don't know if you'll find it interesting. Let me know. I miss you, Chris. Please come back. See you next time.